With each step, a little less energy is gained by eating the thing underneath you on the food chain. That means the bigger a predator you are, the less food energy there is to go around. You compete with others of your species for limited resources. Only a certain number can be sustained. The end result? There's enough food energy in one barn for dozens of mice, but only enough mice for one owl. Perhaps bigger isn't always better. This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Raymond Foundation. Today's program was prepared by William Oram, with help from Scott Tagey in physics and James Farlow at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, top-ranked Anna Ivanovic has been ousted from Wimbledon. She was upset today by China's Zheng Ji. Ivanovic earned the number one ranking after a win at the French Open. Men's top seed Roger Federer won his match today, stopping Marc Jacquel of France. Monday will be a big day for American cyclist Floyd Landis. He'll find out if he can reclaim his 2006 Tour de France title, as the Court of Arbitration will announce the result of a five-day appeal hearing held in New York City last March. A rather unique doubleheader in Major League Baseball today, while both games are taking place in New York, taking place in a different stadium. This afternoon, the Yankees are playing host to the Mets in a rain makeup, while tonight the Mets play host to the Yankees in the opening game of a scheduled three-game series. The Mets lead the Yankees in the bottom of the third in the first game of this doubleheader. The score, 3-2-2. The Chicago Bulls made Derrick Rose their number one draft pick, but it will be baseball, not basketball, he's concerned with today. The Chicago native is slated to throw out the first pitch before the White Sox-Cubs game later this afternoon. The St. Louis Cardinals were swept last week by the Kansas City Royals, and they're looking to make sure it doesn't happen again. The Royals will try to beat their intrastate rivals for the fourth time in a row when the teams meet at Kauffman Stadium tonight in Kansas City, Missouri. And Indiana Athletic Director Rick Greenspan is resigning amid new NCAA allegations that the school failed to monitor the men's basketball team under former coach Calvin Sampson. Greenspan says his resignation will be effective at the end of December. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Prevena Medical Group, where doctors treat people, not illness. More information available at 1-866-PREVENA. The physicians of Prevena Medical Group encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
As the story goes, Noah was told to build a giant ark to survive a great flood. Animals and birds were led on board two by two so they could be safe until the water receded. Today's flooding is minimal compared to what Noah is said to have faced in the story. That being said, the rising water has led to animal rescues in western Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri, and at least one ark floating along the Mississippi River. Jason Parrott reports.
Jan Morse of Pontusic knows that with hot and muggy weather ahead, Nikki is going to appreciate this haircut.
I watch him do sheep all the time. They're just like, zzz, and I'm thinking, why can't we have something like that? These dogs have been done a long time ago. I've been working at this for a couple hours. Haven't got one totally done yet.
The fact that Morse has somewhere to give Nikki, Jamoki, Boo, Cherokee, Pride, Max, and Annie their haircuts is all that she really cares about. When the floodwaters started to overtake her home in Pontusic, Morris says the evacuation process began.
We looked like Noah's Ark trying to get out of there.
Morris and her roommate loaded a small boat with their rabbits, geckos, ferrets, fish, and guinea pigs before bringing their six dogs on board.
We had the dogs put their life jackets on them so that if they fell out, nothing would happen. So when we got in there, we knew that we had a hard time just rowing, let alone trying to watch these guys as they jumped out the side, which is what we figured they were going to do. So here we all were. We had all the cages, and some of them were still in cages, and the whole thing was just full of animals.
With some help from neighbors, Morris's ark made it to dry land. At that point, she and her roommate headed to Fort Madison to drop their dogs off at their temporary home.
Get them on antibiotics. We got any amoxidrops?
Yes, I think
that's
we
Dana Mueller, the president of PAW, Fort Madison's no-kill pet shelter. When the Mississippi River started to swell, she told the volunteers at the shelter to get ready for more animals.
The Department of Ag did call us to see if we could house any, and we said we would double up our population, And in the first week, then, we got approximately 18 dogs.
Along with housing the extra dogs, Mueller says PAW has been working to get pet food to owners impacted by the flood. She says Purina sent more than 20,000 pounds of dog and cat food to the shelter to be distributed throughout the tri-state region. Mueller says one volunteer even stopped in to take food to one of Iowa's hardest-hit communities, Oakville.
You know, it's getting up there, and we told her, we've got cat litter, so she took cat litter with her. We got extra food bowls, you know, because these people have nothing now, you know, absolutely nothing. So whatever we can do pet-related, you know, we want to help.
The food delivery is not the only way animals from Louisa County are getting help from Lee County. Lori Wardlow of Montrose is a veterinary technician. She's been helping at the Animal Protection League's temporary shelter in Donelson.
We'd bring them all here, we'd get the paperwork filled out, take them inside the arena, get them marked with an ID number, take their photograph, give them their vaccinations, and then once we got all that done, we'd take them back to the kennel, which is in the back, and we would put them in their own separate cages. The ones that come in together, we could put them together.
Wardlow says more than 50 animals will remain housed in several buildings at the Lee County Fairgrounds through Independence Day weekend. After that, the pets will be moved so the Lee County Fair can get underway. Wardlow says most of the dogs and cats are from communities such as Oakville and Mediapolis. She says some owners dropped off their pets before the water came. Others at the shelter are strays or abandoned dogs or cats that had to be rescued.
Usually we get a call. We have an emergency number set up here in the office. And the ones that had to leave them behind, they would call us or someone up in their area and say, I have my pet still in the building. I need to get them out. So we would send in the rescue group. We had a Code 3 water rescue that was here for 3 days. And they would go into the houses and get the pets and bring them here.
Bob Root is one of the volunteers working to save the animals trapped in flood water. He says it was a no-brainer for him to pick up his equipment and leave the animal rescue center he operates in Annapolis, Maryland, to come to southeast Iowa.
For myself and most of the others, just because we like animals and just can't stand to think about them, you know, slowly dying in a flooded area or suffering, so want to come out and try to, you know, bring out as many as we can and, you know, bring them to safety and get them back to the people they belong to.
Some of the other states represented at the Donelson shelter include Colorado and Pennsylvania. Rude says his most difficult rescue so far involved several pigs in Oakville.
Three people herded into a little corral we made out of snow fencing, and once they got in there, we shut the corral and then jumped the pigs and wrestled them to the ground, and that was about the simplest version of the story.
While a sense of sarcasm surrounded the impromptu ovation from Rude's fellow volunteers, pet owners throughout Iowa are still applauding efforts like his. Jan Morris is especially grateful to the folks at the PAW shelter in Fort Madison.
There's no words I can tell you what it's like to have somebody just step up and say, yeah, we'll take them for you. We just cried, you know. You just cry. You just thank God that somebody was there that cared.
Morris is at the shelter as much as possible, checking on Nikki, Max, Boo, Cherokee Pride, Annie, and Jamoki. She does not know what will happen to her flooded home in Pontusic or when she will be able to take her dogs home. So for the time being, the six will remain at the shelter and Morris will continue giving summer haircuts. I'm Jason Parrott.
It's all right, Max. You'll be okay. Cutting your hair doesn't really hurt.
Trash. When it's out of sight, it's usually out of mind. But occasionally, garbage grabs attention, especially when it starts costing a lot. Landfill fees are rising, and with higher costs to ship or truck garbage, a lot of communities are scrounging for alternatives to landfills. Sean Ali found one community that hopes a trendy fuel might solve its garbage problem.
For most of us, there is nothing less sexy than trash. But in part of Indiana, that's changing.
One second.
Take your time.
I'm waiting for Jeff Langbin. He heads a solid waste district in northwest Indiana. Lately, Langbin's phone is ringing off the hook from reporters and colleagues. And why are they calling? Basically, it's because Langbin's county is leaning toward doing something new with garbage, something that intrigues trash bureaucrats, maybe even the one in your town. You see, Lake County, Indiana is this close to letting companies convert most of its garbage into ethanol, you know, to run cars. Langbin says his landfill costs are rising quickly. In his case, that would be $42 per ton.
The two garbage to ethanol providers were for $17.50 a ton. And that savings alone made our board say, hey, we have to pay attention to this.
And so Lake County, Indiana sat down with ethanol operators.
And we asked, what does it cost? Is there any of these things operating in the country? All of the standard questions that you would ask.
Wait a minute, 1 second. When you asked who else has done this and they said no one, what'd you think?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the components are being used and have been used for a very, very long time.
Sure, some components of garbage to ethanol technology have been around for a while. But if you ask ethanol producers where they actually turn trash into ethanol, they say they can do it in labs or in test facilities. And that's got some folks in the trash biz nervous.
Guess I'd say I'm cautious and wary of any new technology to process solid waste.
Jeremy O'Brien researches trash for the Solid Waste Association of North America, a trade group. He's seen landfill alternatives come and go.
Early on in the 1970s, we tried a number of technologies, including composting the waste stream. We tried a technology called anaerobic digestion, and then we also tried incineration.
Of those, only incineration survived. But early incinerators had a nasty habit of spewing toxic pollutants, stuff like dioxin, out their smokestacks. O'Brien says incinerators are now cleaner. His point, though, is that it takes time to improve technology, and he worries some communities bent on turning garbage into ethanol could end up holding the bag.
The facility could fail early on, and they'd be stuck without having a place to put their waste.
Indiana's Jeff Langbin says that won't happen to his county. He says the ethanol companies will cover their own financing, and the county will have insurance as a backup. But speaking of backups, there already is another landfill alternative, right?
Why can't we just recycle all this stuff and make it into new things that people buy again?
There are a number of people out there that could give a rat's patoot about recycling. And that's the waste stream that we're having to deal with. The other reality of it is recycling is expensive. So I don't believe it is a realistic possibility for us to just recycle everything, both from a cost standpoint and from a societal standpoint.
So Langbin says recycling helps, but ethanol might do more. He says he kind of wishes someone else would try trash to ethanol technology first, but it is worth testing out. And he says it might be so cheap, he won't even have to hold his nose. For The Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about The Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Hollywood is still recovering from the screenwriters' strike, and now it's looking at another big labor hurdle this Monday. That's when contracts for the Screen Actors Guild expires. The Guild has been negotiating with the studios for weeks, and with the deadline coming up fast, there's no resolution in sight. NPR's Kim Masters reports.
It's not quite clear what will happen when the Screen Actors Guild contract expires, but actors will not be walking off the job. Television shows will keep filming, and as for movies, the studios already all but halted production some weeks ago, just in case it came to a strike.
No studio can start pre-production on a film when they don't know if actors are going to be available.
Michael Schamberg is a producer whose credits include Aaron Brockovich and Get Shorty. He has a couple of movies that are now stalled.
It's like a de facto strike in the sense that actors aren't working, but they're doing it in a way that doesn't give them any leverage on the studios.
In fact, SAG hasn't even taken the first step toward a strike. After weeks of unproductive negotiation, the union still hasn't asked its members to vote for strike authorization. That process would take 3 weeks and require approval from 75% of those voting. Entertainment attorney Jonathan Handel thinks SAG knows it can't muster that level of support, not while Hollywood is recovering from a writer's strike and the economy is bad.
What happens when the contract expires is that we truly enter this sort of netherworld where, on the one hand, you don't have a contract, but on the other hand, you probably won't have a strike either.
SAG is in a tight spot. Normally, it teams up with the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists to negotiate a deal with the studios. AFTRA is the smaller union that represents actors on many television programs. SAG handles movies and most scripted shows in primetime. Despite a long history of mutual antagonism, SAG and AFTRA have negotiated with the studios together for years. But this time, AFTRA broke away and made its own deal. Members are set to vote on it by July 8th. SAG's leadership says the after deal isn't good enough on a number of issues. Attorney Jonathan Handel.
Some of these are good points. Some of these are perhaps a bit much, but the trouble is that most of these are non-starters. SAG doesn't have any leverage left.
But SAG is trying. It's pressing members to vote against the AFTRA deal. And actors are split. Tom Hanks and Sally Field are backing AFTRA. Jack Nicholson and Sandra Oh support SAG.
It's a nasty little battle at this point between the two unions. But the net result is almost certainly going to be that the AFTRA deal will nonetheless be ratified.
If so, SAG will find itself isolated. The writers made their deal after a painful 100-day strike, and directors have a contract, too.
It's hard to see any other outcome for this than that SAG will cave.
Given the time required to prepare to shoot a movie, producer Michael Schanberg says it will take 3 months after a deal is made for cameras to roll again. The only consolation is his projects are unlikely to fall apart in the interim.
My competitors can't make their movies, too, so it's not like I'm going to lose anybody.
And since the writers have gotten back to work, Schanberg can continue to develop new material while waiting for the impasse to be broken. Kim Masters, NPR News.
Earth and Sky.
I'm Jorge Salazar. A robot sub being tested now in Antarctica might someday be used to find signs of life on other worlds. For example, Jupiter's moon Europa might harbor life swimming in an ocean covered by ice. I spoke to Peter Dorn of the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's principal investigator of the Endurance Project, whose robotic submarine will seek organic molecules beneath ice-covered Lake Bonney in Antarctica starting in late 2008. I asked Professor Dorn what life on Europa might be like.
On Europa, we don't know enough to be able to answer that question. There may be higher orders because there could be things like geothermal hot springs coming out of the bottom, vents coming out of the bottom of the ocean.
By higher orders, Dorn means higher life forms, such as those found in the near-earthly hot springs.
And that would supply a lot of material and energy into the system where you may be able to support those higher orders. So if those are there, yeah, you might find some funny Europan fish.
But Dorn said microbial life under Europa's ice would probably be more likely. And as to why Dorn and others want to look for life in strange places like Antarctica and Europa?
For me, it's the most important question we can ask. Did life evolve elsewhere? And it sort of puts us in perspective.
That's our show for today. Our thanks to NASA in celebration of the International Polar Year. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 2 minutes.